everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I have such an amazing guest with me that I was almost in tears when he agreed to come on my show. William Kent Krueger is, I feel, should be our country's author laureate, and you're going to find out why in just a second. So stick with me, won't you? Thank you again for joining me tonight on Authors on the Air. I usually start this segment of the show, the very beginning, by doing a little bio of my guest, but instead I want to read to you from the homepage for William Kent Krueger. This is the first paragraph, and I just love it, and it should set the tone for our conversation tonight. He says, every year on January 1, a door opens. The new year lies before me, full of nothing but promise. There will be walls to be scaled, I know, and unexpected pitfalls to leap. Some dreams will be realized and others will be put aside until I open the door next January 1st. I try to enter every new year filled with hope. I cannot tell you how much joy I get from reading that, and I've read it about 10 times now. Please welcome to Authors on the Air the much awarded and highly acclaimed William Kent Krueger. Kent, welcome so much, and thank you for being my guest this evening.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thank you for having me, Pam. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time.
Thank you. What an honor and a pleasure it is to have you. And I have to say that I love the way your Facebook opens up onto that landing page with your message of hope. And at a time when a lot of people feel hopeless or helpless, and maybe not even now, but maybe every year or every month or every day, and to see that is a very joyful thing. I suspect that you wake up every morning and say, it's a good day, I'm on this side of the grass. Am I right?
You know, I wake up every day and the first thing I think is, I'm going to go right, which is the thing I love most in the whole world. And what a great way to greet every day.
It really is. I do too. I wonder, who am I going to speak to today? What new thing am I going to learn? And I'm so thrilled that you're here because I learned so much about you just once again going over every bit of media I could find about you. I know. I love.
Have you been stalking
story.
Me, Pam?
I have been. I've been cyber stalking you, but I promise, if you know, it's one of those things. My mom used to say, "Oh, I got a hang up call," and I said, "Why is that?" And she said, "Well, you know, if a woman answers, hang up." And so I won't call you. I won't call you and stalk you. I'll just do it via the net. Okay.
It's a deal.
Okay, I'd love for you to talk about first. The Broiler? Do I have the name right?
Oh, sure. Sure. So for listeners out there who have no idea what you're talking about, here it is. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota, and we have an iconic cafe here called the St. Clair Broiler. The Broiler and I began a relationship about 3 decades ago that continued for a quarter of a century and was absolutely essential in my development as a writer. I, for a quarter of a century, went to the Broiler every morning at 6 o'clock and wrote first thing every day. It essentially helped me develop the whole regime that I follow to this day. Every day I wake up at about 5:45 and I get myself dressed and I go to a coffee shop where I write for 2 hours every day. The broiler, my relationship with the broiler began in this way, Pam. My wife had just entered law school and I became the sole support for the family. So I was the guy who had to keep a roof over her head and food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew if I wanted to meet those responsibilities and still develop as a writer, I had to come up with a way to do that. So so I knew the broiler opened its doors at 6, and I told my wife, Diane, if you're willing to get the kids up and dressed and fed and off to school first thing in the morning so that I can go write, I swear to you that when I come home at the end of the day, I will be the best husband, the best father you can possibly imagine. She bought it, so there I was at the broiler every morning at 6 with my notebook and my pen in hand, ready to write. And we followed that relationship, me and the broiler, for, as I said, better than 1/4 century.
Now, is it true that you had booth number 4, it was the mainstay for you, and that really, truly, nobody bothered you when you were writing? You were just part of the broiler itself, weren't you?
Well, some of what you just said is true and some is not. It is true that I always wrote in booth number 4 and that they, in fact, saved that booth for me every morning. If I didn't get there quite at 6 and somebody tried to slip into it, they shooed them out. So it would be available for me. Typically speaking, once I became a published author and began to have a kind of reputation, and it became known that I wrote at the broiler, people would periodically drop by, and then generally speaking, they were very respectful. They would simply tell me that they enjoyed my work, or they might ask me to sign a book that they had. The problem with the broiler was this, Pam: it was the regulars, the guys who were there every day. And so I would go in and I would sit down to write, and this is my writing time. This is precious time to me. But these guys would come over and they would bot themselves down in the booth across from me and proceed to tell me some long, pointless story that they were sure I'd want to include in my next novel.
Aww.
So in the end, that really was part of the reason I abandoned the broiler. I still do all my writing in coffee shops in the morning, but they're just different coffee shops now.
Well, Kent, let me ask you this. It's something I've always wondered, and since you talk so much about the broiler, it's just appropriate that I ask you, what is it that draws authors or writers to coffee shops? Why coffee shops? I don't understand that. Why not libraries?
Sure.
Why not, you know, quiet rooms at a university? Or why not have your own, you know, writing den someplace, or a room off your garage or something? I don't understand it. Explain this relationship that you have with coffee shops.
Sure, I can't speak for other writers who write at coffee shops, but I know there are a lot of us out there. For me, this is the deal. I can't write in a quiet place. And maybe the reason is that my writing regime developed in a coffee shop where everything is all noise. So honestly, I've had this experience, Pam. I've been sitting at home on a day when I had the house to myself, nobody here, quiet, peaceful, exactly what you would, and I still remember this day. This is like in the middle of winter. So there's snow outside, the sun is out, it's all sparkly. It's exactly what you would imagine would be the perfect atmosphere environment for creative work. And what am I doing? I'm sitting there going, shouldn't the furnace have come on by now? You know, I hear everything. The phone rings, I've got to answer it. Somebody knocks on the door, I've got to answer it. I walk by the sink and I go, I've got to get to those dishes. But you know, when I'm in a coffee shop, none of that has anything to do with me. A waitress drops a tray of dishes, big deal. It's not my responsibility. So that environment becomes all white noise. And it's really easy for me to sink myself down deeply into my own imagination, go to another place while all of that noise is around me. It's not uncommon, honestly, Pam, it's not uncommon for me to have this experience. I go in and get my coffee, I sit down, and I begin to write. And an hour later, I come from the place I've been, and my coffee is cold, and it's like I've been in a time warp.
Fascinating. To be so deeply into it, in the zone, the writing zone like that. It's my understanding that you were a huge Hemingway fan. I have to tell you that I had a good chuckle about you wanting to, you know, in an honorable way, kind of follow in Hemingway's footsteps. And the first
well, I know where this is going.
Yes. So maybe you'll share this little bit of story, since I'm a little embarrassed to say it. With anybody else, I would. But please share this story. It's such a funny, it's such a great, great moment.
Sure, and I don't mind sharing it because I put it out there on my website. It's actually a story I have often shared when I do a speaking engagement. So here it is. So when I was 18, my father was a high school English teacher, and when I was 18 years old, he insisted that I read A Farewell to Arms. I'd never read Hemingway. So I read A Farewell to Arms, and I fell madly in love with Papa Hemingway. I liked his writing well enough, but honestly, what I really fell in love with was that mythic image of Ernest Hemingway. Here was this guy who had joined World War I, joined the Italian army long before the United States got involved. He drove an ambulance. He was wounded, got a medal for it. He hung out with the greatest literary names of the lost generation in Paris. He hobnobbed with matadors. He was a legendary brawler and drinker, a big game hunter. And he'd been given the Nobel Prize for writing a kind of prose nobody had ever written before. When I was 18 years old, I wanted to be Ernest Hemingway. So I read everything by him and everything about his process. And in the course of that reading, I discovered an arcane piece. Well, actually, a couple of arcane pieces of information about how Hemingway went about his way of doing things. And the first was this. Ernest Hemingway, for whatever reason, didn't wear underwear. So at 18 years of age, I gave up my Fruit of the Looms for 6 weeks, Pam, for 6 weeks. Then I decided Hemingway must have been made of sterner stuff, and I went back to my beloved boxers. So that was one thing. But the other thing was this. And the other thing is this. It goes... Oh, yeah, audiences love it. But here's the other thing, and it ties into the broiler. One of the things that I knew about Hemingway was that he loved nothing better than to rise at first light and open every day with writing. He thought it was the most creative time of the day. And that's essentially what I ended up doing with my broiler time. Every day, first light, there I was, just like Papa Hemingway.
How wonderful. I have to say that... maybe most of the authors that I speak to also believe that getting up really early and just starting fresh is their most creative and their best time. I probably for different reasons, you know, you were following in your idol's footsteps, and so that's understandable. But in the long run, it worked for you, and that's what's great, because obviously not all things that Hemingway did worked. But
that's true.
I love that story. I think that's great, and I'm trying to envision big Ernest Hemingway with his big gut and his suntan body and, you know, a hard drinker and a brawler and a womanizer, and he's commando, and it's a disconnect for me, I have to tell you, Kent. It's a disconnect. You also led kind of a gypsy life, which I found fascinating. Now, my brothers swear I was raised by gypsies, so maybe we're connected. You know, we spoke earlier before we went live about everything being 6 degrees of separation. You know, we're all connected somehow. So they, because I'm so unlike my brothers, so they just say, well, Pam was raised by gypsies. But you truly led a very gypsy-like existence. You moved so many times, but you loved it, which I think is really fascinating, because generally kids who move a lot don't like the experience because they can't get embedded with a group of friends. They're not in the same schools. They're always the new kid on the block, and it's very difficult for – those are challenges that a lot of children don't overcome. Tell me about your experience, please.
Well, my experience, I am the third of four children. So were you to talk to my oldest brother or the brother just ahead of me, they might tell you a different story than I tell in terms of how we responded to all of the moving that my parents had us do. I always looked at it as an adventure. For me, going someplace new was as exciting as all get out. And leaving friends behind wasn't very... it wasn't traumatic for me at all, simply because I made friends easily, and I left them easily. And the other thing was this, I come from a very close-knit family, so when we moved, it wasn't like we were all alone. I had my brothers and my sister with me, and so we all helped one another make that transition. So really, all of us are the kind of people who very quickly fit into a group. We understand how to make an impression, a good impression. For me, all things considered, it was a terrific experience, all of the moving that I did. And it gave me so much background that I continue to draw on in my writing. So I lived on farms, I lived in small towns, I lived in big cities. And I've used all of those experiences at one point or another in the stories that I've written.
Well, let's talk about your stories, because I want to know the genesis of Cork. I want to know where he came from, how he came to be. Will you talk a little bit about probably your most famous character?
Sure. For those of your listeners who may not be familiar with my work, I'm probably best known as the author of the Cork O'Connor mystery series, which is set here in my adopted state of Minnesota, up in the Great North Woods. My protagonist, Cork O'Connor, is a man of mixed heritage. He's part Irish-American and part Ojibwe. Cork actually came to me long before I had an idea for any kind of story. I'd been thinking for a while about a character who might be interesting to write about, and initially, really, all I knew about him was this. He was going to be the kind of guy who was so resilient that no matter how far life pushed him down, he would always bob back to the surface, and his name would be Cork. So that's all I knew about him to begin with. Then,
what a great way to start a character, though. My God, that's amazing.
Oh, really? Really?
It's such a great visual.
So when
too.
I decided to get serious about my work and made the decision to set my writing up north and took a really good look at the North Country, I realized you can't set a story in northern Minnesota without including the Anishinaabeg, the Ojibwe culture, as an element of the story, because the Ojibwe's influence is everywhere in northern Minnesota. It's very powerful. So I knew that I was going to have the Ojibwe be a part of every story I wrote, and finally made the decision to make Cork a man of mixed heritage, part white and part Native, which has contributed significantly to a lot of the great conflict that goes on in the stories. So that's sort of, and, you know, then I decided I have to write what I know, and I'm a family man, so I made Cork a family man. I'm married to a blonde attorney, so Cork's married to a blonde attorney. Cork has some children, I have children, so, you know, there are a lot of parallels there. So Cork evolved then, particularly as I was creating the first novel in the series, Iron Lake.
He's a fascinating character. I like everything about him. I like reading about him. I like learning more about him in each book that you publish. He's a fascinating character.
Well,
but
thank you.
I would like to know.
I sure enjoy spending time with him.
I bet you do, and I'm so glad you're continuing to write about him. I have another question, and then we're going to take a call from another writer, as a matter of fact. But you are a natural storyteller, and I sense that just from even reading your website without having – I could probably not read one of your books and still know that storytelling is a part of who you are. And I mean that in the very best sense of the word. But You also are very fascinated by the Native American mystique and myth, and they have a rich tradition of storytelling also. Do those factors combine, do you think, when you sit down to write and to create stories?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. My joy in writing stories feeds right into the Ojibwe tradition of telling stories. It's an oral tradition, and it's rich in stories. I try not to draw the true stories that the Ojibwe themselves tell and use them on my book. I think that would be a trespass. So typically what I try to do is create stories that are very Ojibwe-like in all of their elements, but they're my own creations.
How much research do you do for your books, Kent?
Oh, lots. Every mystery writer I know who's worth his or her salt does an enormous amount of research, because we are so often writing about topics we know absolutely nothing about. Very few of the writer friends that I have any kind of a law enforcement background. The lucky ones do, but most of us have to research and learn everything. I'm not native at all myself, so I've had to do an enormous amount of research in terms of the Ojibwe culture. So, yeah, we're always researching. We're always reading. We're always going out and talking to the folks who know the stuff we'd like to know.
Do you enjoy the research part?
Yes and no. I would much rather just be writing. But I have
found that
in the research I learned so much that's important, not just for my writing, but just, you know, in terms of my understanding of the world, the broader world.
How fun. Let's take a call. I'm pretty sure this is Rebecca Warner, who is also a writer. Rebecca, welcome back to Authors on the Air.
Hi, Pam. I'm enjoying this so much. I love your questions, and it is such a pleasure to hear your wonderful voice, Mr. Krueger.
Well, thank you.
It just is a perfect voice on top of...
Well, you have a pretty nice voice yourself, Rebecca.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. I wanted to congratulate you on your... Edgar Award for your extraordinary novel, Ordinary Grace. Were you really excited about receiving that? Was that expected? How did you feel about that at that point in your career?
Well, it wasn't expected. The competition was extremely stiff. Great, great books. Really fine authors represented among the nominees in the year that I won. And honestly, I went into it not expecting to win. I really had picked out one of the other books, a really fine author and friend
really?
Of mine. Louise Penny was up that year, and I thought Louise's book was going to win. So that when they announced my name, I was over the moon.
Oh.
I was excited, thrilled, honored.
And next is the Nobel, like Hemingway, okay? That's what you're striving for now, right?
Yeah, I wait every day for the Nobel Prize committee to give me a call.
But, listen, they gave it to Bob Dylan. It could happen. Dylan got one. So, and never showed up for the award. it could happen.
Rebecca, here's the thing about awards.
Uh-huh.
They don't sell books. Unless
really?
They're huge, like the Pulitzer, the
Nobel. People would consider the Edgar pretty huge.
Well, you know, there are those people who read mysteries understand what the Edgar is, but a lot of people out there, if you said he won the Edgar, they go, what?
Oh, okay.
So they don't really, but you know, it feels good to win an award, particularly an Edgar, which is an award given by your peers in recognition for your work. And your publishers certainly love it, but it doesn't drive sales particularly.
But you really don't think that awards sell books?
I don't think they do. I mean, we slap that on there. Do you know what sells books?
What?
People talking about them. That's what sells books.
That's true. So often I've been so happy to overhear someone speaking about a book and thinking, or they're just talking about something. You've got to read this book. And I found so many wonderful books, yours included, in that regard. But if I may ask you a question, and then I'll let Pam get back to her fabulous interview. I love the questions you're asking, Pam. I'm learning so much, and I especially love learning about the Ojibwe and how you relate to them. But your book, Sulphur Springs, That's not coming out until September. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I have to just say, in reading about what you did in last year in 2016, your trips, I love the way you set that up and all the things, but you're talking about what the book is about. You're at the Montezuma Pass and the Coronado National Memorial, and you're saying that it's also a corridor for the entry of illegal aliens seeking sanctuary here in the States. And it's going to be about this difficult situation confronting Americans north and south of the border, now marked by an enormous fence, visible even from the great height that you were at when you said that. Did you know Trump was going to do this?
I'm prescient. I knew Trump was going to be elected, and this is where it was going to go.
We all did, right?
I've been quite fortunate in the timing of many of my stories. For example, last year's novel Manitou Canyon, which involves the struggle of a Native First Nations group in Canada to preserve their sacred area against the invasion of people who want to essentially destroy it for money, mining, and that kind of a thing.
Right.
And the Dakota Access Pipeline coincided, right. So the Sulphur Springs, the issue of the fence and our treatment or reaction response to the refugee situation as they risk everything to cross the border seeking sanctuary is when I have been to Arizona on a number of occasions, and the more I was there, the more I became aware of the situation. Because I like to write about issues, I think they're important, and I think mysteries are a wonderful way of bringing important issues to the attention of people.
Yeah.
Because they'll read about an issue in a mystery, whereas if you present them with a polemic, they'll just go to sleep or turn it off. I love doing that, and
you
so
do it so
was,
well.
For me, it was a natural.
Oh, it was a natural. It was the next progression. But don't you think sometimes, have you ever thought to yourself, when you're talking about being a little prescient, like with the Dakota Pipeline and with this fence, do you think when you go in that zone, these kinds of things just come to you?
Do you know, I think when you're a storyteller and you really sink yourself deeply into wherever it is you go to get your inspiration in your stories, you're touching a place that's a little bit sacred. And things come out of there that are so far beyond your own abilities. You know, every writer I know talks about it that way. We all understand
that. You said that so beautifully. That is true. And when you combine that with your research and your talent, what gifts you give us. But anyway, so I just wanted to know who tipped you off. But I am looking forward to this. And isn't it going to be interesting? Because we might be in the middle of building that wall when this book comes out.
Yeah, I hope I didn't say anything in the book that's not going to be true about the time that it actually is published. We'll see. I'll have to work with my editor on that one.
There you go.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
This is Rebecca Warner herself, an author. She's been a guest on my show and a co-host, and she will be again. Thanks for calling in, Rebecca.
My pleasure. Thank you
so much.
It's
been a pleasure talking with you, Rebecca. Thank you.
And with you. Thank you. Good evening.
Bye. It is kind of funny, your storylines, the gist of your story, it is interesting, because when I read Manitou last year, I knew nothing about the DAPL, you know, situation, and of course it's a horrendous thing, it's horrible. I don't understand how the first Americans have been so shabbily treated. It's a conversation for another time. I want to talk to you a little bit more about your books, and I specifically wish to discuss Ordinary Grace with you, the book that for me changed the way I look at books. I told you before the show that I was so stunned by your prose. The writing was so perfect in my mind that I went back and read the story out loud, and it's something that I do often enough to realize that I get a whole new experience from reading out loud. It is truly one of the most magnificent books I've ever read in my life, and I bet you that every year I will read it again.
Well, thank you.
Please? You're so welcome. Thank you. Will you please tell me how Ordinary Grace came into being?
Sure. Ordinary Grace was one of the riskiest endeavors I've ever embarked on. For this reason, Pam, many, many years ago, my publisher called me out to New York City and set me down and said, we only want Cork O'Connor novels from you. I won't go into why that is. But when this idea came to me that was clearly not a Cork O'Connor novel, I knew that it was going to be a risky proposition if I actually tackled it, because clearly my publisher wasn't interested. I had no idea if anybody else would actually be interested in publishing it, but it was a story that spoke to me on such a deep, compelling level that I had to write it. There are really two motivations for writing Ordinary Grace. The first was this. I'd been looking for a story for a very long time that would allow me to go back and recall an important period in my own life, the summer I was 13 years old. For those of your listeners who are unfamiliar with Ordinary Grace, it's really a pretty simple story. It takes place in the summer of 1961. It's set in a small town deep in the very beautiful Minnesota River Valley. It's the story of a Methodist minister whose beloved child is murdered. That's the compelling mystery component. But at heart, it's really the story of what that terrible tragedy does to this man's faith, his family, and ultimately the entire fabric of the small town in which he lives. So I had been looking for a long time for a story that would allow me to go back and recall an important period in my own life, the summer I was 13 years old. Ordinary Grace is told in the voice of a 13-year-old kid. And I wanted to be able to write it in such a way that I could use bits and pieces of my own life to create this story. So the Drum family, at the heart of the story, I'm really writing about my own family. The town of New Bremen is so like the small Midwestern towns I spent so much of my life growing up in. There are places, there are people out of my past that populate this story. And I wanted to write it in such a way, too, that readers who were born decades later could read that story and know what it was like to be a 13-year-old boy in the summer of 1961 in a small Midwestern town. So that was one motivation, but the other was this. I wanted to write a story that would allow me to explore more deeply the whole question of the spiritual journey in our lives, in the lives of all of us, I believe. Readers familiar with the Cork O'Connor series may be aware that there is very often an undercurrent in the stories that deals with the spiritual journey. It's something that comes very naturally for Cork O'Connor. He's a man with a foot in two different spiritual traditions, his white Catholicism, he's Irish Catholic, and his Ojibwe spirituality. And so in the stories, he's very often trying to figure out where his own spiritual path lies, which has been an issue for me all my life. So I wanted to be able to write a story that would allow me to explore that issue of the spiritual journey, the importance of the divine in our lives more significantly, and that was Ordinary Grace.
I have to tell you that just the title of the book alone is so huge to me, because grace, my world, comes in so many different forms and fashions and means so many different things to me. And so when you put it together with ordinary, so it becomes Ordinary Grace, it takes on so many meanings in my life. I am a recovering Catholic. You know, I had the indoctrination at a very early age from you know, studying for First Holy Communion and then, you know, going to the catechism classes and being in the youth groups and doing everything. And And after a while, when I got older and I was able to look, the way we were raised, Kent, is kind of odd, that I thought everybody was Catholic, but like our next door neighbors were Baptist Catholics. And the guys down the street were Jewish Catholics. I just didn't know any better. You know, my parents were never said, oh, we won't talk to them because that's the Protestant family. I just thought everybody was Catholic and you were just went to a different kind of a church. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
It made for growing up very easy and without prejudice, I have to say. So it you know, was confusing to me to realize that there really was a huge difference in religions. I knew that like the Middle Eastern and the Eastern religions were different. I knew they weren't Catholic, but I was pretty certain most of the earth, you know, the entire world was Catholic. I was pretty certain there was. So when I first heard the expression ordinary grace and similar expressions, I think they came from one or two popes who were more progressive than some who weren't. And it evokes a very good feeling in me. So I want to thank you for that. And there's something else that I have to mention. I listened to you answer my questions and speak to Rebecca and all. You have just a naturally lilting, lovely, nuanced voice. And your patterns of speaking and the words that you use remind me of my parents telling stories when I was little. Not that we are very close in age, I want to say that, but you have a very refined way of speaking, and it's such a pleasure to listen to you.
Wow. You're using I'm going to have to come on your show more often.
You should. Your use of vocabulary and the language is just such a pleasure to listen to you speak. Thank you for that.
You are so welcome.
It's a joy. Now, you know, we spoke earlier before the show went on, and you asked how did I read so many books, and I told you there was one genre that was so easy to read, I could read 3 books in a day in that particular genre. When I started reading your books, I really took my time with them because I could tell how much you love the language. A lot of authors don't pay tribute to the language.
Well,
I talk to
groups and I'm talking about the reasons that I write, one of the primary reasons that I write is my love of language. My father was a high school English teacher, and he taught me the power of language very early. I learned very early that words have power, that words, if you use them correctly, move people in very mysterious ways. So when I choose my own reading, those books that I want to read on my own, one of the most important criteria is the quality of the language that's being used in the telling of the story. I can stay with a less than stellar plot so long as the language is just stunning, mm-hmm. beautiful, compelling language.
Whose books do you like to read, Kent?
Well, it depends. I sort of split my time between mysteries and non-mysteries. If I'm reading mysteries, I read the mysteries of people who write what I write, who write out of a love of the language, who write out of a powerful sense of place, who write out of a deep respect for the creation of complex, believable characters. So James Lee Burke, I love his stories. They're very, very dark, but oh my God, does he write beautifully.
He's a magnificent guest, too. I have to tell you, he's fascinating to speak to. Very
he's one of the people
man.
That... Yeah, he's one of the people I've never actually had an opportunity to meet in our business, in our community, and I would just love to be able to sit down and just talk with him for a while. So maybe that opportunity will happen one day.
Yes.
Let's see, Dennis Lehane, I think, also is just such an incredibly powerful writer. When I'm reading, reading in the genre, I tend to read Midwest authors. I think a case can be made that there is, in fact, a Midwest voice in literature. Tends to be a very spare but very eloquent voice and rises, I believe, out of an understanding of our relationship with this land that we occupy. We pride ourselves in shaping the land out here in the Midwest, but in truth, the land shapes us. So I love reading the work of Marilyn Robinson Gilead. Kent Hariff is one of my favorite authors. Let's see. Guys, you probably don't know Kent Myers, another Kent, who's just a beautiful writer. I love reading Midwest authors.
How wonderful. What do you like to do in your spare time other than read?
Oh, my wife and I walk a whole lot. We're big hikers. I love to bike, play tennis. I like working out at the gym. I like spending time with my grandson and my children. Big family guy. So there you go. I have no problem filling my time.
I bet you don't. Are any of your siblings creative besides you?
Yeah, they're just not necessarily writers.
That's okay.
Hey,
what
Pam, everybody is creative. Everybody has some sort of a way, a unique way of expressing themselves. I just happen to be the one who has done it with words.
Well,
in my family.
I think that's true. I think that's true. But I do think that creativity also runs in families. And I often find that when I speak to writers, they have siblings who are maybe actors or photographers or do other things in the creative arts. So I'm always interested in knowing, are you the stray gene in your family, or do your siblings also exhibit creative talents as well and pursue them?
I would have to say that if that's how you're defining it, I'm probably the creative one in the family.
You are. And are your children interested in the arts at all?
Oh, yeah. My son for a very long time was a poet. He's sort of given that up. He creates video games now, which is very creative.
That's very creative, sure.
And my daughter has always been a writer. So, yeah.
How fabulous. Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. How fun. Whose book is on your nightstand right now?
I have a book I have a book that nobody will be reading for quite some time. It's a book called Fateful Mornings by an author named Tom Bauman, who's just, I think this guy is one of the best writers in our genre, or any genre today. It's his second novel, Fateful Mornings, and I was just blown away with it. It'll be out sometime this year.
Wonderful. I love getting advanced books. I love getting galleys of books that are coming out. I'm so blessed to be part of this tribe that you authors include me in, and publishers who send me, 50 books a week to look through. I have an embarrassment of riches. So I get to pick and choose, what grabs me on the first two pages. And if it doesn't, it's gone. It's a terrible thing. I don't ever get throwaway books, by the way. I give away a lot of books. But very blessed to have a lot of those, too. I'm very blessed to get a lot of those books way ahead of time. So like Dennis Lehane's book, for example, which I've started. I have about 7 books going right now. So,
oh my goodness.
Isn't that crazy? I know. I can't help it.
I do one at a time.
Because they're so good, and it depends on my mood, and I can't say, I'm just going to sit down and read this one book. And I say, I'm not in the mood to read this. Let me try something else. And sometimes I'll read it all the way through, and sometimes I won't. I have Jeff Deaver, whom I adore. I would walk over glass to read if he read a post-it. If he wrote a post-it note, I'd do it, But I have his new The Burial Hour, which isn't out yet. And I just am addicted to it right now. I can't put it down. So everybody else's book has to wait. It's crazy. And even Dennis Lehane's that I started and so many others that I'm almost there. I'm almost finished. But that's what happens when you love reading. Noah Hawley, who's been nominated for an award this year for Before the Fall, has a most exceptional book that I want to finish. But, you know, Jeff Deaver pulled me right in. I tell him that all the time. Write a post-it note, I'll read it and review it, you know. do you like to listen to music, Kent? And if so, what kind?
Well, typically I'm listening to jazz. If I'm at home, if I'm in the car, I'm typically listening to our NPR classical station.
Mm. Yeah, I'm an NPR.
But if I'm working a crossword puzzle or working a jigsaw puzzle with my wife, I'll put on the Beach Boys or some old stuff. Love that.
Really? How fascinating. Will you please tell listeners where they can find you on the web?
Sure. I'm at www.williamkentkruger.com. Pretty simple.
And the next book, Sulphur Springs, will be out when?
It's due for publication September 5th.
And there is talk, I hear tell, that perhaps maybe sometimes there will be a sequel to Ordinary Grace?
Not a sequel, Pam. I've always called it a companion novel.
A companion novel.
Done with the Drum family. But I call it a companion novel because, like Ordinary Grace, it's set in southern Minnesota rather than the northern Minnesota of my Cork O'Connor series. And like Ordinary Grace, it's also set in an earlier time. But it will be similar in some ways to Ordinary Grace, but it will be entirely different kind of a book. I've done Ordinary Grace. I'm moving on.
I hear that. And I'm going to let you move on because I've kept you way over my allotted time. William Kent Kruger, to me, the master storyteller, you should be our country's author laureate. I cannot tell you that often enough how much I enjoy your work and how grateful I am that you took the time to spend with me this evening. Thank you so much, and I wish you a joyful year.
Thank you very much.
Will
and
you
I wish us all
sometime?
A hopeful year.
Absolutely. Will you come back?
I will.
Thank you so much, Kent. Have just a wonderful weekend. Enjoy yourself.
And you take care, Pam.
Thank you. Good night, Kent.
Good night.
And thanks for listening. I have the best life. I do. I get to talk to the most brilliant people. Thank you so much for being with me. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, all.